This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, if you're listening to this, I will assume you're at least interested in money, understanding the economy and finances as well. And some of us now want to get the next generation interested as well. So check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. Tune into Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcast. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. Get 1 month free and an extra $10 when you sign up for a Greenlight account at greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating over 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The economic news of today comes down to two words, housing, for the actual economics of it, the state of the housing market, if you will, and also jobs, for the politics of it, the state of the union. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by iShares Exchange Traded Funds. Learn more about their ETFs at 1-800-iShares or iShares.com. iShares, keep evolving. And by the all-new Chevrolet Volt, available soon in select markets. Details at ChevyVolt.com. The all-new Chevrolet Volt. It's more car than electric.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Good to have you here on this Tuesday, everybody. It's the 25th of January today. And while the president will focus on jobs in his speech, we will do housing first on the broadcast, mostly because it's an actual economic indicator that we're working with. Home prices fell in November. That's the national headline from the S&P Case-Shiller Index that came out this morning. And in a number of big cities, prices have dropped to their lowest levels since the worst of the housing bust. From Washington, Marketplace's David Gura reports.
The latest Case-Shiller Index did have some good news. Home prices in Washington, D.C. and three California cities were higher in November than they were the year before. But overall, prices fell for the fifth straight month. Susan Wachter teaches at Wharton. She says a big problem is high unemployment.
That's the tale of the whole housing market. When jobs recover, so will the housing market.
Also holding down prices is what she calls excess inventory, otherwise known as unsold foreclosed homes.
We have to work our way through them, and that will take time.
Some analysts are worried all this could lead to a dreaded double dip. That would happen if home prices fall below their previous low set in April 2009. David Blitzer oversees the Case-Shiller Index.
Everybody wants to be able to issue a great sigh of relief that we've passed the bottom. But of course, if it looks like we're approaching a new bottom, we can't do that.
The housing crisis led to the recession, but Blitzer notes it'll take other economic forces to help the housing market recover. In Washington, I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
The day's big event, of course, is the State of the Union address. Opinion polls show voter expectations for what they want from Washington over the next 2 years are pretty clear: more jobs and lower deficits. But since government job programs cost money, what's a president to do? Our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale has our preview of the speech.
White House officials say the president will lay out a case for keeping America more competitive in the global economy. He'll ask for investments in education so companies have skilled workers, investments in infrastructure for moving products and people, and support for jobs in innovative technologies such as climate-friendly sources of energy. But some economists say that all sounds just like the two-year-old stimulus program that failed to bring down unemployment. And Kevin Hassett, a former economic advisor to Senator John McCain, says the resulting deficits limit what the president can do now.
He's in a very tricky place, but I think all policymakers are. We're in the tricky place because we squandered so much money on government spending in the first time around.
Hassett says the best policy now is for the government to simplify business taxes to create incentives for new hiring, and then get out of the way.
We don't know if tomorrow's job creation is going to come from small business or big business, multinationals or local firms. And so the only thing that we can do is create a tax code that's neutral towards all these things, and then we'll let the market decide how we're going to grow in the future.
But not all economists worry about too much government spending.
I wish he wasn't so concerned about the deficit. I wish he'd try to stake out that position.
Dean Baker with the Center for Economic and Policy Research says companies won't hire workers until there's more demand for their products, and more favorable tax rates won't change that. He says government, even with huge deficits, is the only guarantee for short-term job creation.
There is a logic to investing. I mean, we're improving the infrastructure, we're investing in modernizing the power grid, in having electronic health records. So much of the stimulus that he actually pushed through in 2009 was investment. You know, we could use a lot more of that.
Baker concedes Republicans won't let the president borrow more. Instead, he's hoping the Federal Reserve will keep interest rates low for a long time to allow the economy room to grow. There's a risk of more inflation, he says, but not more deficits. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Changing gears here for a bit, the Pentagon has been trying to wean itself off petroleum for years now, experimenting with biofuels as a way to save money and lives since fuel convoys have become tempting targets. But a report from the think tank RAND says that's a nice dream. It's not perhaps so realistic. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Eve Tro reports.
The RAND Corporation says the military is spending too much time and money on biofuel research, especially for technologies that it says are nowhere near ready. Jim Bardis led the RAND study.
You know, there's no doubt that this stuff is technically possible. The question is, can you do it for any reasonable price?
He points to a Navy program that runs ships on a fuel that comes from algae.
They had to pay $424 a gallon.
He says biofuel research might be more efficient and get to the mass market faster if left entirely to the Department of Energy. But Nathaniel Green at the Natural Resources Defense Council says the military prides itself on pushing energy innovation beyond current market interests.
Their interests are more than just frontline security. They're really a part of protecting our national interests, and that definitely means moving away from petroleum.
The Navy has been particularly outspoken about the value of its biofuels program. It says RAND's estimates of the cost and viability of certain technologies are not in line with its own research. Joel McCower is executive editor of GreenBiz.com. He says many biofuel producers have organized their research and development to suit the military's efforts. If Congress does cut defense spending on biofuels, would it mean some companies disappear?
Probably not, but it'll definitely slow down not just the development of the company, but the development of the technology.
He says it's not just the military's money, but its highest standard stamp of approval that could move biofuels more quickly into the mainstream. I'm Eve Tro for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, might as well not have traded at all for what little change there was in the major indices. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Three years ago, Marketplace's Sarah Gardner did a story about American nuclear power, about how that industry was gearing up for a big comeback. There were new tax credits, building permits, regulatory changes in the air back then. Suffice it to say, a lot has changed.
It's always instructive and humbling to go back to stories I've reported and see how things turned out. It's like playing Where Are They Now, but with news events, not celebrities. So I dug up that 2007 nuclear renaissance piece from the Marketplace archives. It opens with a soundbite from David Crane, the CEO of NRG Energy. His company had just filed the first petition to build a nuclear power plant in the U.S. in nearly 30 years.
It's important for all of us to recognize that that was then and this is now. The nuclear industry today is not the nuclear industry of the 1970s.
When I interviewed Crane in 2007, he was jazzed about safety advances in nuclear technology and new federal loan guarantees. Other utility execs were too. By 2008, they'd drawn up plans to build at least two dozen new reactors here. Fast forward to 2011.
All I would say is that the process has taken a very long time.
Crane still hasn't gotten a desperately needed loan guarantee, and his company's already shelled out $500 million on this nuclear venture, and they haven't broken ground yet.
I think the reality caught up with the hype, so to speak.
Energy analyst Paul Patterson says it's not just NRG's nuclear power dreams that are on hold. In fact, most of a few dozen proposed reactors are in limbo. Congress never did pass limits on the greenhouse gases emitted by coal-burning power plants, which would have made fossil fuels more expensive and nuclear power more competitive. And federal subsidies never reached the levels that nuclear lobbyists hope for. But the biggest, baddest enemy of that nuclear revival? Cheap natural gas. Again, CEO David Crane.
It was absolutely not predicted by anybody, expert or soothsayer.
A glut of natural gas has driven down prices and now makes nuclear look wildly expensive. Natural gas is a fossil fuel, but emits half the greenhouse gases of coal. Energy companies have discovered and tapped into huge reserves of shale gas in the U.S. Bernard Weinstein is associate director of the McGuire Energy Institute in Dallas.
We've got at least a 200-year supply of natural gas in the United States. So if you're a utility executive and you're scratching your head, maybe I don't want to commit to a nuclear plant right now.
Peter Bradford, a former nuclear regulator, says nuclear power's always been a hard sell. Its history of cost overruns and plant cancellations means Wall Street won't touch it. And the feds are cautious, too. Last fall, Constellation Energy walked away from a promising nuclear project in Maryland. Bradford said the Department of Energy demanded what Constellation called a shockingly high fee for a government loan guarantee.
The nuclear industry's position now is we can't go forward in the face of a fee like that. We need something that's more like a gift.
And right now, any gifts from the feds are unlikely. So what happens another 3 years from now? If the experts are right this time, the industry will be lucky to have a few nuclear reactors under construction. Of course, as this story's taught me, things can change. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
If past State of the Union speeches are any guide, at some point tonight, President Obama is going to say that America needs to invest more in education. That's a message Wendy Kopp has been trying to get across for 20 years. Kopp is the founder of Teach for America, a program that sends young and passionate college graduates out into some of the poorest performing classrooms in the country. In her new book, it's called A Chance to Make History, she reflects on the progress that has been made and some of the challenges yet to be met. Problems that can't be solved just with better teachers or more computers or more money.
I mean, I think all of us feel such urgency to solve this problem, and it is a true crisis that we kind of lurch from one big idea to another. And the reality is that, you know, when we look at what is happening in the schools that are putting whole buildings full of kids on a path to graduate from college at the same levels as kids in much more privileged communities, when we really understand what's happening there, what we realize is this is about a group of people, teachers, school leaders, who have embraced a different mandate and who are then pouring themselves into this work with the same level of energy, the same level of discipline that we would find in any high-performing organization where we're trying to reach ambitious outcomes. And I think we tend to kind of try to oversimplify the problem. I mean, if only it were as easy as pouring more funding into this.
Well, you have actually a great example in the book. It's in the chapter, incidentally, called Silver Bullets and Silver Scapegoats. You have this example. It's the School of the Future in Philadelphia, $62 million facility. Technology provided by Microsoft, everything that the kids could want. And yet, on the Pennsylvania assessments, this school fails miserably.
Yeah. This is just the classic example of, you know, a very well-intended effort. But without an understanding of the true drivers of truly transformational, successful education, which requires a lot more than any one thing. It's going to require extraordinary leadership at the school level. It's going to take obsessing over who every one of those teachers are, developing them over time. And it's going to take a lot of extra supports for the kids who do bring extra challenges and face just all the burdens of poverty.
There are schools in this country that are doing it right. Some of them use this concept called the whole school. It starts early. It ends late. They're there for the kids 24/7. They give them food and homework help and all that. Is that what it's going to take?
It's going to take an all-out effort. You know, I think about your Philadelphia example, because there are extraordinary schools today in Philadelphia working in the same neighborhood as the, quote, school of the future that are literally accomplishing just unprecedented results. And the way they've done that is to be very clear about, here's the mission of this school. They work very closely with parents and with the kids, and they invest them in a vision of academic success. And then they go about doing the hard work.
But along those lines, you know, you have been steadfast in your career in leadership and education in this country that quality teaching makes a difference, that the person who stands at the front of that classroom has a disproportionate impact. And yet you say in this book there are limits to what you call heroic teaching. Given what we pay these people, given what's expected, they can't just keep going like this for 25 years.
See, what I've been steadfast in over the last 20 years is the idea that we need to channel the energy of our country's future leaders against the problem of educational inequity. You know, to the discussion we were having earlier about, it's easy to oversimplify the problem. I actually think that anyone who believes that the answer is just to change the teachers, everything I've learned over the last 20 years would tell me that that's not the way to go. We need everyone in the picture to change. But the easiest way to improve the quality of teaching is to take on the whole school. Like, this is an organization issue, and we need to focus on ensuring that our school leaders have the foundational experiences that they need and that they are driven to build high-performing teams and to develop them over time.
Wendy Kopp is the founder and CEO of Teach for America. Her new book about the future of education in this country is called A Chance to Make History. Wendy, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
There's more in that book, obviously, than what we just talked about. You can read about it and find an excerpt on our new book blog. It's on our website, marketplace.org/thebigbook. Coming up, science in the kitchen.
I can use a laser to cook a pixel of food and get it exactly as warm as I want, exactly as slow or as fast as I want.
Get out your Bunsen burners and step back. Freakonomics Radio is straight ahead. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials paired some early losses today, wound up shedding just 3 points, less than a 10%, closed at 11,977. The NASDAQ added a point, also less than a 10%, finished at 2719. The S&P 500 was flat, ended things at 1291. Disappointing earnings from blue chips initially dragged down the Dow. American Express surrendered 0.2%. 3M gave back 2%. Johnson & Johnson, hit by product recalls, shed 0.8%. Today, Verizon had a weaker than expected quarter two, but it issued a bullish outlook for its pending Apple iPhone business. Verizon shares gained 1.5%. Apple dealt a blow to Eastman Kodak. I'll connect the dots here. Kodak shares plummeted more than 13% after losing a patent infringement case involving Apple. Apple shares polished up 1.7%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Ally Bank, offering its Raise Your Rate CD as well as an online savings account and money market account. Learn more at allybank.com. By Constellation Energy, committed to customer choice and powering America's clean energy future through investments in natural gas, nuclear, wind, solar, and efficiency technologies. And by iShares Exchange Traded Funds. Learn more about their ETFs at 1-800-iShares or iShares.com. iShares, keep evolving. Every day, be sure to wake up to the Marketplace Morning Report. It's 8 minutes of radio you can't afford to miss. You'll hear updates on all the latest developments in business and finance as they happen.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on sales of new homes for the month of December. A two-day green car summit gets underway on Capitol Hill. And speaking of cars, the General Lee made its debut with the Dukes of Hazzard television premiere on January 26, 1979. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl, and I'm going to go out on a limb here and guess that you probably use at least one of the following: a smartphone, a laptop, or an iPad. And that's in addition to the desktop computer you use, maybe at home and maybe the one at the office. Well, each and every one of those devices has something called an Internet Protocol address, or IP address. It's a little bit like a phone number that lets you dial up the Internet. And you know how sometimes a place runs out of phone numbers and has to add area codes to make the calls go through? In about a week, the most common type of IP addresses are going to run out as well. Marketplace's Jennifer Collins reports.
Today, I went looking for my computer's unique IP address.
I click on that. Oh, and my IP address is 64.162.
Okay, it's not the most exciting thing. Dan Campbell is a consultant with network engineering company Millennia Systems.
It's probably the most trivial and should be the least expensive part of a service.
Most IP addresses, 4 billion of them, are in our primary system. Those are about to run out. So Campbell says many companies will try to get customers to share. Bear with me here. If an IP address is kind of like a phone number, sharing them is kind of like a party line. Remember the 50s movie Pillow Talk? Doris Day and Rock Hudson starred as neighbors with a shared phone line.
They had absolutely nothing in common except a party line.
Would you please get off this line?
Martin Levy of internet service provider Hurricane Electric says sharing creates new problems.
It could be that the streaming of a video is not going to be as smooth because you're competing literally against your neighbor.
Levy says there's a more permanent fix. Another IP system is available, and it may have more addresses than there are stars in the sky. But companies have been slow to change because it means new equipment and training costs. Still, Levy says staying put could mean lousy internet service and could be costlier in the long run. I'm Jennifer Collins for Marketplace.
It's time once again for a little Freakonomics Radio. It's that moment every couple of weeks where we talk to Stephen Dubner, the co-author of the books and the blog of the same name. Dubner, what are you doing?
Eating a hamburger. Delicious.
Okay, but why?
I'm doing research for your program because it's really interesting if you think about what we eat and why we eat it, and especially, here's what I want to know, how we might eat in the future.
All right, I'm game, so go ahead.
Well, there's a trend going on, fascinating to me, weird, where kitchens are kind of being overrun by scientists, or at least chefs who love chemistry and physics. So if you look around at some of the world's highest rated restaurants, they're serving things that you or I might hardly recognize as food, things like a dehydrated leek ring, or where you might go in and you have your chocolate cake, but you instead of eating it, you smoke its essence through a pipe.
Yeah, see, that's not what I want. I want the actual cake and a cup of coffee. But go ahead. Keep going. I'm intrigued.
Well, this movement, as you may know, it's called molecular gastronomy, and it's going to get a big bump in visibility in the next month with the publication of a very unusual book called Modernist Cuisine. It's unusual for two reasons. The first is it is huge. There are 6 volumes, 2,400 pages, $625 list
really?
Price.
Okay? Seriously?
Seriously, you can get a little discount on Amazon. But and here's the second reason it's unusual. Its principal author is Nathan Myhrvold, who many people know as the former chief technology officer of Microsoft. Yep. He runs an invention company now called Intellectual Ventures. Here's the thing. Myhrvold trained as a physicist and a chef. Now, here's how he likes to think about making something as simple as a hamburger.
Cook it to perfect medium rare. Then you dunk it in liquid nitrogen, which freezes the outside. Then we deep fry it. We pop it in a deep fryer or use a torch on it. And either one will give you this incredible crusty outside, but because you put it in liquid nitrogen, that prevents it from overcooking. So you get perfect medium rare hamburger.
Wow. Okay, so two things. One is that that's not what I would have thought Nathan Myhrvold sounded like. I had him pegged slightly deeper, but that's neither here nor there. The other one is I have this grill in my backyard, and I don't need liquid nitrogen and a deep fryer and a blowtorch, man. I throw some patties on the thing, and I'm done.
You can keep doing that thing. There are no worries.
All right.
And to be fair, about two-thirds of the stuff in this cookbook can be made without a laboratory or a blowtorch. But Myhrvold's point is this. It's time to bring the scientific method into the kitchen because most of us, if you think about it, we don't really know much about what actually happens when we cook.
For people that want to just in a rote way repeat exactly what they were told to do without understanding why it works, hey, go for it. You don't need me. If all you want to do is repeat the recipes of the past and you have no curiosity as to how or why it works, then you don't need to have this physical understanding.
Full disclosure here, though, Dubner, I am a big fan of Alton Brown on the Cooking Channel, right?
He's
the guy who does
the
chemistry food. Big fan of his, and so you'd think I would go with this Nathan Myhrvold
but
thing.
But I smell no. I smell a big no coming.
You know why? Because it's no. I don't get it.
I hear you. You can think of this as like a bunch of rich, brilliant people just playing with their food, right?
Right.
And you know what?
I mean, come on. The guy has Microsoft stock coming out his ears.
And I could defend that position, but let me make a counterargument, okay? Here's what's interesting to me. We are in the midst of a very interesting kind of natural food, slow food boom, right? And there's obviously an upside to that. But I think we fail to appreciate how far food science has already gotten us. So there are crop scientists like the late Norman Borlaug who boosted crop yields so much he saved millions, maybe billions of lives. Mm-hmm. Napoleon, believe it or not, offered a cash prize to anybody who could help feed his armies better. That's how we got canning. So I'd like you to listen to Pablos Holman. He is an inventor who works at Myhrvold's company. He's trying to develop a device that could make millions of different foods anywhere without you or I having to go to the supermarket. The device is a food printer.
Just like an inkjet printer you have at home, instead of putting down droplets of ink, I'm putting down droplets of food, right? But I control every single pixel, right? I can use a laser to cook a piece of a pixel of food and get it exactly as warm as I want, exactly as slow or as fast as I want.
I don't even know what that would look like. I can't, help me.
It sounds crazy.
Yeah.
It sounds crazy the same way that it might have sounded when someone suggested that you would make a meal in something called a microwave oven,
yeah,
perhaps, right? And the food printer, the idea sounds crazy until you think about how, if it could work, how it might come in handy if, let's say, there's a tsunami or a big famine somewhere. You could airlift in these food printers. A few hundred toner cartridges of food could churn out hot meals and medicine for weeks.
Yeah, and of course, the refills on those cartridges, just like my HP inkjet at home, would be like $900,000. But anyway, Stephen J. Dubner, Freakonomics Radio. You can see more on his podcast. It's freakonomicsradio.com. Dubner, put the food down.
Put the food down.
We'll see you in a couple of weeks.
Bye-bye.
Freakonomics Radio is supported by Microsoft, providing comprehensive business solutions for the cloud. You can learn more at Microsoft.com/cloud. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, focused on finding opportunities one stock at a time. On the web at putnam.com/large-cap-equity. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, courtesy of Andrew Ross Sorkin and his Dealbook blog over at the New York Times. The World Economic Forum is about to start over in Davos, Switzerland, the annual gathering of the economically rich and famous. Emphasis here on rich. Sorkin has run some of the numbers. He breaks it down like this. Basic membership in the Economic Forum, which you need to even be able to buy a ticket, and then buying a ticket at the door in Davos, will run you $71,000. That is the lowest individual cost you can get. Companies pay a good deal more, topping out at $622,000 for a party of five. Sadly, food, airfare, and lodging not included. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media here in Los Angeles, where I'm happy not to have to go to Davos. Today, the Dow gave up just 3 points, less than a 10%. The NASDAQ added a point, also less than a 10%. The S&P 500 was flat, ending right where it started. Thanks to Ethan Lindsay and Jolie Podokas on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Rod Abid. You can tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. Coming up next time on this show, while telecommuting is a double-edged sword.
It's quite possible to generate more energy from the building standpoint by telecommuting than you save.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Do hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.